Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, April 1st. It really is a hearing, even though it doesn't sound like. We're going to continue with our agenda. Did you want to do this one first? Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Public Health from Oregon Health Authority, and Senate Bill 5527, a fee ratification bill. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Public Health is back today to finish up, and there's also a slide or two right at the end for the Health Licensing Office, which this biennium was moved into the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay. Hearings on this day.
I guess that's the meal thing. It's like deja vu.
Good morning, KCAR Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. I'm Lillian Shirley, and I am the Health Department Director for the State of Oregon's Oregon Health Authority. And thank you for having us back this morning. I believe that we last met, we were beginning a discussion around the reduction in substance abuse health issues in the state of Oregon. In the context of this slide, this is, as we pointed out yesterday, this is one of the three leading causes of death in our state, and one of the major areas that we're focusing on. So this is also a good news story in terms of what we can do together to look at things that are impacting our population. About 15 years ago, the issue of overprescription of opioids became a national problem across the country. We talk about emerging diseases, emerging issues. This is an example of something that is recent in its emergence as an issue, a health issue across the nation. So what has happened, and you'll see particularly the decline that is there, and I think that this gets to why work on the ground, work with prevention programs, work with programmatic and policy issues kind of come together to have a good outcome. In 2009, this body had a bill that really started the prescription drug monitoring program, and we looked at how we could get a better handle on this together. A couple of things happened to that. We understood that we followed what was happening, and we made it transparent across both providers and the population and people who were in need of prescription drugs. We took methadone off the preferred list, so people had to think very carefully about prescribing it and have a dialogue with the patient themselves. The Oregon Health Authority and the hospital systems began a lot of research around the implications of this, as well as doing more public information campaigns about the issue. And that let the issue be known and understood. For example, one of the results of that research was understanding that if you're on high doses of opioids over 90 days, it actually becomes less effective. You know, so this is information both for the prescriber and also the patient who needs it. And we've focused more in our state on alternative pain treatment. Some of the things that we're moving forward with is to set guidelines for chronic non-cancer pain guidelines, and moving our affected population down to lower dosages for continuous chronic issues, and having medication-assisted therapy and recovery options together. So a real true integration between primary care and mental health and substance abuse kind of intervention, so that we can look at it more holistically. So I'm just going to see if there are questions on that.
Question.
Oh, yes.
I did ask for the methadone question. We've had a nice drop in, especially in males, of drug overdoses killing people. Methadone has always been a drug I've been particularly concerned about, because people can get overdosed, not be aware they're overdosed, go to sleep, it stops respiration, they die. And so when I looked at some of these numbers here, you're talking about for every 2,000 prescriptions of methadone, you have one death. For every 20,000 prescriptions of other opioids, you have one death. That's a 20-to-1 ratio. And for what we call benzos, benzodiazepines, these are Xanax and whatnot, you've got 121 for every 125,000. And in there somewhere are mixtures, people taking multiples of these drugs at the same time. What I'm really interested in is, you know, methadone is, I think, is the one we have to worry about here. That's probably causing the vast majority of these deaths. It's still being used in the state. And we have methadone clinics that are handing it out, which I have real concerns about. Methadone was first designed to be used for heroin withdrawal. Now it's used on a chronic basis for control of narcotics for people. And they become addicted to methadone and then buy street drugs, and the combination can be deadly. So if we really want to get down here and get this thing under control, I think we're talking about methadone, methadone clinics. And this is from the point of view of death, not necessarily lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to have you look at that a little bit more if you could. I mean, I'd be a happy guy the day we close all the methadone clinics in the state down. I think they're an abomination. But people are making big money out of it. We got private corporations that are making money out of this, and I would hear about before I walk out of the room, they're making a huge amount of money out of this, keeping people permanently addicted to methadone. I'm very concerned about it.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a question of the good senator. There was, and this was several years ago, where there was some discussion that long-term use, also methadone, created other actually medical problems and issue, particularly with some damage to, I think, I thought it was liver and other places. And I don't think we've explored that either as time has gone on.
Well, I do see this as a public health issue. Mm-hmm. It's just that big. So if you come back with some more information, I'd like to see what your thinking is on it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to digress, but it's a serious issue. Okay.
So the next topic that we're going to look at is the suicide rates in Oregon. And as Representative Olson pointed out, it is definitely an issue for us as a whole community. The trends in suicide, which Senator Winters asked about yesterday, we monitor the nation trend-wise, but we are 30% higher consistently. And we did look last night at parallels with the economic conditions, and we've seen a recent uptick both in the national rates as well as here in Oregon, and that is in the slides that you in the handouts that you got, but we're not able to really match it or make a conclusion that it has any relationship to the recession in 2008. Suicide is a very complex issue, but I just wanted you to know that we did look at that and we can't draw any conclusions, but we do have that data. The rates of suicide in Oregon, as I said, have been higher, and not just 30% higher, but higher for 30 years. So this is, kind of a chronic problem that the community faces. And firearms were used in more than half of all the suicides that we saw. And Oregon suicide mortality mortality from suicide attempts does really vary by age and by race. White suicide rates steadily increased across the age span, and then they decline at age 65 to 74 years of age. But for our Black and African American population, suicide rates followed a very different pattern than the white population. They peaked at ages 25 to 44 years old, and then 45 to 54 years before they steadily decline in the later years. For American Indians and Alaska Natives, they have the highest suicide rates among race groups, and at age 15 to 24 years, the earliest, and they peak at 45 to 54 years of age. For Asian and Pacific Islanders, the suicide rates are lowest rate among the race groups, and they peak in ages 25 to 74 over that whole lifespan. We've we've plotted this out. As you can see, it's not just age and race differences. There are differences across the state. So this is one of the ways we want to share information with our local partners, our community-based organizations, so that they can also figure out, you know, what are the issues in their own communities to be addressed around that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Looking at the data you've given us here, I was waiting for you to comment on it. Just roughly looking at the suicide rates, if I added up all the rates by age, race, and ethnicity, and then I compare that to veterans age 18 to 24, and I don't know if you're counting veterans in the other group too, I would say that just looking at this, and maybe I've got the numbers wrong, considering this number of veterans we have in the state and the number of suicides, we've got an epidemic on our hands. Am I looking at that number right?
1 in 5 suicides are veterans in the state of Oregon. Yeah.
I think we should draw attention to that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe mm-hmm. Am I reading these numbers correctly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I know that the VA is trying to work with this, but do we have any way of contacting veterans and working with them from a public health point of view?
We've begun.
Your job is to give us the statistics, and I appreciate that. Maybe that's all you need to do, and it's our job to make sure this is done through
right.
another method.
Well, but, you know, it's how we have begun conversations, actually, with the VA around how to make some of this information actionable to specific communities and subgroups. So a lot of the technical assistance we provide, and we focus basically on the youth suicide rates. That has been, your guidance over the last session as well. And we just actually Monday had a meeting with AMH to implement some of across alcohol, mental health, and public health interventions for youth prevention. We have begun discussions around the issues with veterans groups and veterans advocates groups. You know, what can we do to help them understand where the problem is and how to intervene more effectively? But this is an emerging problem, correct?
These are young men and women, 18 to 24. This isn't, you know, guys my age are veterans. This is young people coming back and committing suicide.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Lillian, I was looking at this piece, the suicide in Oregon adults, adolescents, and adults. There isn't a message on here on crisis lines about the suicide prevention line for veterans, and I'm wondering if that would help what Senator Bates is mentioning too, that they some other things that we are currently doing, although, you know, the person has to be motivated to call the line.
Correct. Yeah, that's we can look at that. These are regular reports. You know, what I said, that, you know, one of our chief products for Oregon is information and data that people can then use. And these reports we put out annually. So these are they're on our website. We can modify that. We can also put linkages to crisis lines. As you, on the back of the adolescent and young adult report that we put out, we do have those, and we can do that on for the veterans as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that suggestion.
And we just noticed that follow-up. We just noticed that, or we're reminded, it was not last session, so 2013 session, that a bill was passed to add that hotline for veteran suicide prevention to the tax checkoff in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a little, that's another way that people can know about it. So.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two just questions so that I understand the statistics properly on this, on what's being added into this suicides in Oregon sheet you passed out. One question just for clarification, the bottom right graph has numbers on suicide attempt and self-harm hospitalizations. I'd be interested in hearing the distinction there, if self-harm is cutting versus actual suicide attempts and why that's separated. And then the other is, I'm curious, out of all these numbers, are physician-assisted suicides included in any of these statistics?
The answer to your second question is no, and the answer to your first question, I'll have to get back to you on that. Is that all right, Representative Starr? Okay.
This, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. William, the one, I appreciate all this information, but the one point is, I got flat tail, is rather disturbing, but I mean, I've seen it too in the past. It's your fourth bullet point on the suicide. It talks about rates of suicide in Oregon have been higher than the U.S. for the past 30 years. And we rank in the top 10 among states for this incidence. It's amazing what the contributing factors are. And I realize that down below a little bit further, it talks about depression and mental health issues. We're supposed to be living in a beautiful state. The irony here just doesn't seem to work.
I completely agree. I mean, I myself found it very shocking, you know, once these statistics were brought to my attention a couple of years ago. We are working really across the Oregon Health Authority in a way that is kind of different, not programmatically, because suicide is such a complex, multi-factor. It has to do with, as Senator Winters was pointing out yesterday, we don't understand the impact of isolation, the impact of economics, all those factors. So is it, you know, we can't address the problem alone. We have to look at across all of our agency work. You know, how can we make this a priority, and what are we all doing, you know, to kind of address that? So I completely agree with you. And that's one of the reasons you'll see it, you know, called out on, you know, our state health improvement plan, that we can really begin to talk across the state in different communities and give them information about who's at risk, looking backwards at what's happened in their community, who may be at risk going forward in their community, and what can we do to support that and intervene. But I completely understand your concern, Representative. Yeah.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you collect the data, and I'm going to go back to veterans, when you collect that data, does it any way tell you some of, not all, because it is a complicated issue, but things like whether the veteran actually had been in combat, some where the veterans returning home was able to obtain employment. Can you give, because, you know, we look at variables, are those actual things that could have some causation, you know, with this population? Do we extrapolate that kind of information?
That kind of information.
How many of them were homeless?
Yeah, that kind of information, if it's on the Oregon death certificate, we can analyze. But a lot of it, the kind of questions that you're asking really would come from almost a death review like we do for child fatality reviews, what led up to this. So that's different than we can actually just pull down, but we can't. There are ways of kind of identifying how to go after that that information. But currently, we don't have any. It's not part of our current funding around the birth and death certificate, the vital records. But it's also something that independent researchers could do at the VA. So that's an opportunity maybe for us to take that and say, where can we can maybe work together to get some grant funding where we could do a joint project with the VA and OHSU, as well as the State Health Department, to get better understanding of what's, you know, what are the predetermined factors that leads up to this outcome.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Are there any states that actually do that kind of compilation?
I can check for you, Senator Winters. I'm not aware of hand. I'm sure if I went through the Centers for Disease Control, they would know.
Because I think it is, it is an alarming statistic. Mm-hmm. And, there's been a lot of discussion here in this building about serving the needs of our veterans. So I would appreciate it.
Absolutely. We'll get back to you on that.
Representative Stone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious. I always see these annual reports. I've never seen it broken down monthly. And so I'm wondering if there are studies or if you have data that shows, seasonal effects, yeah. You know, like seasonal affective disorder and mm-hmm. what those rates are. Okay. And I'd also be interested in seeing if there's a difference based on season, if we have any sort of marketing, suicide prevention mm-hmm. marketing strategies around those seasons.
Well, can I put that on the follow-up list? Because that's a great suggestion. Thank you for that question and that suggestion.
Okay, let's advance to the next.
So just one, changing gears here. Public health has a public safety function that isn't necessarily always as visible in communities as our, say, maternal child health work. We are a strategic partner in the state's emergency response and recovery. This is a pictorial representation on the slide in front of you of an assessment that guides our work in planning with communities, health systems, and clinical partners. Some examples of where we have worked together very strongly across the system is the H1N1, Ebola, the winter storm flooding that happened a couple of years ago. And public health may not always be the first responder in these situations, but we need to understand and prepare for the impact of human health in these disasters. We receive a total of over $10 million in federal funds to work with our partners for emergencies. And much of this money goes out to hospital systems and local governments to make sure that we have our system. The recent example of the response to the threat of Ebola in this state and this nation, I think, was an example of the investment paying off, where the system could really pull together very quickly from the first responders and the ambulance transport to individual hospitals for assessment to treatment, really working as a system together. So we always have challenges, this lists some of the ones that particularly we try and address and work around. Population changes in the state and the changing drivers of poor health. We've talked a lot about that yesterday and today. Some of the stresses on the local public health system, and I think, the legislature is working very hard to address some remedies for this with House Bill 3100. Significant natural disasters and disease outbreaks. For instance, we talked about Ebola, also meningitis. You may come to work in the morning and have your whole week planned, and then you get a call, and suddenly it's all hands on deck, and defer to addressing this real, honest, significant issue that has come up during the day. Increased diversity in our state, making sure that we understand, and we talked a little bit about we're not applying best practices that don't work for some of our diverse populations, that we get in dialogue with them about what are their cultural expectations of us as a system. We have the fastest aging population in the United States, and I know that's some jaws are dropping. It's that also was interesting for us, and we've.
Why are you looking at us, well, Madam Chair? Talk to the House, please, for a while.
I'm just looking at my cohort. I'm with you there.
So, really understanding what that means. But the good news is we're living, we're aging, that's one of the good news. And we've been working at trying to address more systemic approaches to this, so not thinking of it programmatically, but recently we in the state of Oregon have joined with the state of Georgia and the state of Connecticut to look at how can we pull together the work that is done across public health to really work in concert with our aging and disability services, and what can we provide for them to understand more. And that's been actually very well received, and we're learning a lot from those partners that we have, from the the nonprofit partners like our AAAs, as well as our aging and disability partners that are working with people that have disability. And this concept of healthy aging, what, you know, whether we're looking at worrying about children being able to get safely to walk to school, we're also looking at, you know, how can our elders have communities that they can age in well. And then lack of skilled workforce, I just want to say we have some of the most dedicated, wonderful, competent workforces across the state on all levels, community-based organizations, locals, governmental and state around public health, but our, the skill sets that are being required as we move into the future are also slightly different than the skill sets that we needed in the past. And what are those training issues? How do we work with the state's initiatives around workforce training? And and then, you know, gets back to that other bullet point, aging.
Madam Chair, I can't help
Senator Winters.
Thank you. I can't help it. But you talked about walking.
About?
Walking and
walking,
some of those,
yeah.
Aging gracefully. You left out dancing.
That's true.
I mean, can I sign up for that program?
I mean, honestly, I have a neighbor who is in her 80s who teaches line dancing every Monday at the senior center in Kaiser, and she's very fit. Dancing is a good exercise, and I know that my cohort over to my left would agree.
That's right. That's a many old the swing dancing. I want to get first off, I'm a little uncomfortable here. You know, like you're talking to me, but there is something here that's important for other budgets. I did not realize we were the fastest aging population in the nation. That's really important for our DHS budget, which is being driven to a great degree by caseloads in various areas, but it's part of it's the elderly caseload and the DD population. Could you give us a little more information about that? That might help guide us in that discussion of that budget, too. A little more of a breakdown. Are we really an outlier compared to the states? A lot, or a smidgen, but give us some idea what the demographics look like going forward, because that is important information. Yes. That's one of the things public health does for us, is give great information so we can start looking at policy the right way. Well, that's kind of an eye-opener. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can add on, could you actually give us, when you bring that data back for Senator Bates, if you're seeing an uptick in in-migration numbers, and I'm particularly interested because just recently the banking community, I believe it was, did a survey and said that, I mean, Oregon was not in one of the tops for a place to actually come to retire. Actually, we were just right about it. So I would be interested to know, when we talk about the fastest growing aging population, some of those factors that are contributing to that growth.
We will definitely get back to you. There's two things. Oregonians don't leave, and then people do come in, maybe not as fast as other states, but there is, and then we know we have a lot of, 35 to 45-year-old in-migration, and their parents come when they start having children. So not one factor is pushing us over the edge, but this is combination. And we're beginning, Senator Bates, to answer your question, it's an issue that we've asked ourselves, how can we understand this better? So we will definitely, make sure we get back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So opportunities.
What member that we asked her?
What member what?
Senator Bates, you're sensitive to this, aren't you?
You're Senator Olson. Oh, yeah, you're Olson.
But we do have a lot of opportunities in this time and space. The House Bill 3100 really establishes a foundation for us to look at how we can move forward and, address and integrate the issues that we're addressing. We talked yesterday about some of our work across state agencies, really formalizing our work across state agencies so that we can have better accountabilities for that work that we are all engaged in and it can be more transparent. Also, public health accreditation, which I know that you have heard about in other issues, we're almost there. We are expecting to hear in the next couple of months about the state being a public health being accredited by the Public Health Accreditation Board, and many of our local communities are doing that. That provides a standardization and an accountability and a transparency that we just we just haven't had in public health work in the past. And then our alignment with the Early Learning Council. In fact, that's very exciting for our work with families and young children. And we are working very closely with that. The appointment of the new OHA director is a great opportunity to kind of bring that together, because she previously, she's still serving on the Early Learning Council, so she brings a knowledge of both perspectives on that. So. Okay, and then, poverty, sorry. So this slide is just, this is to look at some of the issues that we're trying to address and let you all know how we're trying to change our perspective, not programmatically by programmatically, but what is happening across the state and what are the resources and the gaps in resources across the state. So that all of our work needs to be on a platform of who amongst us are, you know, in greatest need and how can we work. So all of these variables that we talked about, population, age, whether we're talking about communicable diseases, whether we're talking about chronic diseases, while we do this, we have to understand, you know, across the state where we need to hook up with others to really have a collective impact for some of these areas. That we know socioeconomic status is one of the major drivers for outcomes. We have been saying that we're working with healthcare transformation and the coordinated care organizations, and this is just a short list of how we've identified the 29 CCO incentive and core measures, both of those measures, and worked with the CCOs to say, like, well, the work that public health does in the population outside of the covered lives in all of those communities that you just saw in the previous slide, you know, what is it that we do beyond the clinical work that contributes to being able to meet Oregon's goals for healthcare transformation? Because the CCO measures are really, they're not just their measures, they're our measures of how we're going to change the model of care and get better outcomes. So that all of the work that's done population-wise is also contributing to meeting those goals. And this is the first time, I think, we've had the civic space and conversation, civic conversation, to really talk about those things together. So how does all that work get funded? The federal funding, as we've talked about before, is the largest source of dollars that comes to the Oregon Health Authority for the Public Health Division. 67% of our funding for 2015-17 is federal funding. Our general fund is 8%. The public health budget, kind of, we're going to break it down in the next five slides so you can see where the dollars come from into different areas of work. And we've talked about the different centers that we have, so we're going to look at it that way. And it's designed to take it so you can see how that effort is split. Also, there's big differences in what the feds fund in among that work, and that will be clear. And we're going to kind of then show how the dollars are allocated across the system and what stays at the state level from all of our funding sources and what's distributed to our local communities, both local government as well as community-based organization. 56% of all the funds that come into the state public health division, regardless of source, actually are passed out to our partners. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Cullum to walk us through the specifics of that framing of how we're going to present our budget. Okay.
Thank you, Lillian. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Cullum. I'm the budget director of the Oregon Health Authority. On this slide, as Lillian was just describing, this shows you where the $528 million is distributed within each of the three centers. We have 23% of the budget, again, total funds, for the Center for Public Health Practice. Only 5% of this is earmarked or directly within the Office of the State Public Health Director. 46.9 million, or 9%, is within the Center for Public Health Protection, and then 63%, this is a large component of it, is within the Center for Prevention and Health Promotion. The reason that this particular slice, or shall I say, almost three quarters of it, it's larger than a slice, is so large is that this is also contributed from the Women, Infant, and Children non-limited funding. So this is the infant formula rebate as well as the WIC vouchers. The public health budget by center and then by fund type consists of the $12.7 million in general fund in the Office of the State Public Health Director, $3.5 million of other funds, and $12 million in federal funds. This consists of things such as grants and contracts from the federal government and foundations. The federal funds is primarily from the Preventive Health Block Grant, which of course is just targeted for those types of efforts to do the performance management assistance to local health departments and where there are prevention efforts in place. And then the general fund piece is primarily a pass-through, as Lillian pointed out, to the local communities known for the state support for public health, often referred to as the per capita. The Public Health Center, by fund type for the Center for Public Health Practice, is $122 million. Again, this supports 290 positions. The large component here of other funds consists of the fees and or revenues that are from the Center for Health Statistics, i.e. vital records, the immunization funds for the voluntary support that they reserve in order to upgrade the alert immunization system, and then the public health laboratory where all of the metabolic screening takes place and the clinical laboratory inspections also occur. And as Lillian mentioned in yesterday's presentation, the public health laboratory, the revenue that they also receive there is also contributed from the multi-state arrangement that they have for doing the metabolic screening in the five other states. The federal funds piece of this is contributed by the acute and communicable diseases, such as the HIV STD program, again, the immunization grant, which comes from CDC, as well as the emergency preparedness and security. This is both the emergency preparedness funding as well as the hospital preparedness. The Center for Health Prevention, this is the large one that I'd mentioned earlier, the $331 million. Again, a large portion of this is contributed from the infant formula rebate. That's the slice identified as the $40 million, other funds non-limited. And then an additional $102 million is the federal funds non-limited. Those two components there are from the Women, Infant, and Children program. Those are the vouchers and the infant formula rebate. The $144 million of regular federal funds are the large grants such as the Maternal and Child Health Block Grant, injury and prevention, breast and cervical cancer screening, as well as reproductive health is the other component. The reproductive health consisting of two major components, both Title X funding as well as the Title 19 for the contraceptive care waiver. In addition, for the other fund components are the ballot measure 44, what we often refer to as TURA, that's the tobacco use reduction account for tobacco prevention and education. The Center for Public Health Protection is $46.7 million. Obviously, it seems to be much smaller from the others in size and complexity, but there's a large other fund component here. This is sometimes referred to as almost the regulatory or licensure function of public health. And within this area is where you're going to see a lot of fee-based programs, such as the drinking water program, healthcare regulation and quality improvement, as well as radiation protection. Another large component of this particular budget is from the medical marijuana program and the marijuana dispensary programs. Federal funds, the major contributor in this particular bucket is the drinking water program, where there is a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency that does require a 3-to-1 match. So the feds contribute $3 for every $1 that we have in the drinking water program. And there was a legislative choice made 4 years ago where the general fund in drinking water was swapped out, and the state's contribution for that match is now brought forward from the medical marijuana revenues. So the other element that Lillian had touched on is that, so what do we do with all this state-level funding, and what's the actual breakdown of this? As she said, almost 56% of this is passed through that goes to either local community-based organizations or local health departments. Virtually all of the voucher money in WIC goes out the door, both the infant formula rebate as well as the federal funds. There is pass-through of an additional $121 million collectively of federal funds that go to the community partners. There is $81.8 million that stays at the state level for other funds, and from the other funds, that's primarily the regulatory and fee-based programs that we were just mentioning, including medical marijuana and the public health laboratory, as well as $131 million in state-level funding for federal dollars. One element that is often questioned, or where we actually do have a lot of interest, is what do we do with the general fund that comes to public health? And what we've oftentimes tried to do is to be able to give a high-level exhibit on this is where the general fund dollars for public health in the governor's budget reside. Again, as I mentioned earlier, a large component is the state support for public health, often referred to as the per capita, immunization dollars, disease outbreak, HIV, STD, laboratory services. The laboratory services for general fund, apart and separate from the newborn metabolic screening, this covers basic things of general microbiology and virology for disease and communicable disease testing. The WIC 0.3, this is a small portion that does fund the farmers market and helps contribute to the match requirement that we have for the federal dollars we pull in. Maternal child health programs, this is going to include such things as Babies First and oral health, breast and cervical cancer. The Patient Safety Commission is a partially a new element in regard to the public health budget. This is funding that was moved into the Oregon Health Authority's budget as part of 1315. The Patient Safety Commission really is best aligned with healthcare regulation and quality improvement, so a decision was made to move that from the OHA budget into public health as part of the 1517 governor's budget.
3-1.
Representative Boone. 3-1. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to look at the breast and cervical cancer screening. Is $1 million enough to make sure that everyone gets screened?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we are actually analyzing that data now at the request of your staff. I think what we did last biennium was that we did receive a boost in funding for the screening element. One of the complexities that we're currently analyzing is a decline in the breast and cervical cancer screening population as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But then for those populations that still are either uninsured or uncovered, we're analyzing to see whether or not that funding is still sufficient.
Can you follow up?
Yes.
Are you using some of these new things that these are anecdotal, I'm sure, coming out in the news reports about, I've actually heard one doctor say you shouldn't go to a doctor and get a mammogram or any screening unless there's a problem. So, but I can't even quote where it was from, but what I've heard, though, is lowering the number or the frequency of required mammograms from one every year to one every whatever years. And I don't know about the cervical cancer screening, but I'm concerned if that's what's happening and it's being done to save money or, that's kind of where I'm headed with this. Just, I think we should make sure, and it sounds like you're looking into it, everyone who doesn't have it through their insurance or whatever, but every woman gets screened for these.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I have probably the expertise or the understanding when it comes to the dollars and cents and the programmatic aspects of that. I'm going to turn over to Lillian if she has a response.
Okay.
So we're looking at it from multi factors, not just numbers and not just where people are getting their coverage. But the issue that you bring up is a conversation that's going on around clinical care guidelines. So that would be something that we would defer to our clinical care advisory boards. And wouldn't make that decision independently based on numbers, but based on what is the best practice, what is the guidelines, that we need to look at going forward for these diseases. So,
and just a final follow-up, just to make sure that what's considered in that decision-making is genetic background, et cetera, family history.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I worry about the age thing, with the, especially the mammograms.
Yeah.
There are a lot of young women who don't think they have to get them, and then they get a lump, and they go, can't be anything. I'm going to wait till I'm 40, and then they get cancer.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, just to put a note on this for you, this is not being driven by financial considerations. There's been several studies indicating that despite the really heavy emphasis we put on breast mammograms, that we have not really changed the outcomes very much. Mm-hmm. And we may be actually dealing with, we're not sure yet, they're doing a lot of work on it. We may be dealing with basically two types of breast cancer, one that's very aggressive and the one that isn't. Mm-hmm. And if it's very aggressive, you could have a normal mammogram today, a year from now, you could have metastasis,
right,
where the other one may not be. And so we're really looking at those numbers, trying to figure this out, and it's not an easy thing to do. On cervical cancer screening, we've actually moved it 2 years now, not every year. Mm-hmm. And some of that's depending on some other factors also, where last pap smear showed and whatnot. Mm. We're just looking at these things because we're not getting the results we thought we would get with the guidelines we have. And so I just want to reassure you, it's not being driven by money.
Okay. Thanks.
It's being driven by what's the right thing to do, what's the science here. We're just not sure right now. And for many of us who've spent years doing things a certain way, to be told that maybe you were doing that was necessary or it's wrong, we have to be willing to say, hey, we're going to look at this and see what's going on. Okay?
Thank
so
you.
It's just, it's not a money thing. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Bill or Lillian, throw Kate in there too. The WIC program, now that's a match.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, yeah, it is correct in regard to the farmer's market.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And just follow up then. So I'm trying to kind of figure this out. I understand what WIC is all about. How, and this, I know this isn't your part, but how does TANF play into that then? Temporary assistance to needy families, because that seems to be, you know, another alternative that a woman or infant or child could use as well. But I'm trying to kind of figure the, is there duplication here? That's what I'm interested in.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, admittedly, I know probably next to nothing about the temporary aid for needy families, and unless Lillian has a better understanding of that, that's information we'd have to collaborate with Department of Human Services to bring that information back.
Okay, I'll do that. That's okay. I'll figure it out. But thank you.
Yeah, I think anything we would say, Representative Olson, would provide clarity. I'd rather come back with actual, you know, research into the separate issues.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to ask something that I know some of what we're talking about is borderline whether the discussion belongs here or in a policy committee, but it does it does relate to what we're spending our money on, is it effective, and what our priorities are. So one of the things I'm interested in hearing at least a little about is, what do we know about the cumulative effects of imaging tests when we're encouraging people to have diagnostic tests throughout their lifetime? I don't know how many dental x-rays I've had, and I've been reassured, they're nothing now. But for years, as a child, my parents spent money to have proper health care and dental care treatment for my brother and me. And so we've had so many dental x-rays over our lifetime. And then there are the occasional accidents that happen. You know, well, someone falls down, do you have a broken ankle? Or other things happen. And there are CT scans. There are mammograms. What's the cumulative effect of we're telling people to have these diagnostic tests over a lifetime? And I had a discussion, I'm going to make it personal, I had a discussion with my physician assistant a couple years ago, and she said, it's time you not have this one. She said, we have asked you to do this and this and this, and they were telling me about an option for colon cancer screening. There's now some new test, and she said, but we are going to ask that you not choose that option because it's too much exposure for you. So I'm concerned about all sorts of different agencies and messages we're getting about having so many tests, and there's a point at which maybe we should be a little more careful.
Well, one answer to wear a little badge, desert radiation, but the amount of radiation you get from plain x-rays and from mammograms is really pretty negligible now. You get that much radiation if you fly from here to Denver at 30 or 40,000 feet. On the other hand, the dyes that are used for CT scanners and what amount of radiation you get from CT scanners is significant, and it's been overused. And some of that, to go to back to Representative Boone's position, some of that's driven by financial considerations. It's cheaper to do a CT than an MRI. An MRI is completely harmless. And so many times we're forced to use a CT before we even get an MRI. And there is a real issue there, and that is a policy decision that we should be looking at, not in this committee, but the other. You're absolutely right. I'm very concerned, and many physicians are, about the amount of radiation people are getting from CT scans. We're now separating by at least a month in most practices, and even that we're wondering about. The amount of radiation is really, really kind of concerning, and we're not looking at it until about 5, 6, 7 years ago. We have had, and then with the lack of information amongst physicians, I've had people in my practice show up, and I went through the records, and they'd been seeing 4 or 5 different doctors in 2 or 3 different cities, had a dozen CT scans within 1 year.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's a real risk. Mm-hmm. And we think that something like 10 to 15% of all chest cancers will be induced by excessive radiation from CT scanners over the next 20 years. So it is a real problem. And thanks for bringing it up. We need to deal with it at the policy committee.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Winters.
Not on this, but I would like to, because I'm still kind of bothered by the highest poverty areas in the state, and I'd just like to ask a question, and you can follow back up with it later, because it was Lane Lynn and Benton Lynn. And we get so many different pieces of data that my question is, what is your data feed in order to come up with stats? Because we get, we may get a different set of high and lows if I'm talking to SNAP. So it's kind of interesting. I'd like to know if we've got a universal place to where when we start talking about poverty in Oregon, that is a feeder for all of our subject matter. And you may not know it, but maybe DAS does.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the source of that particular data feed for the poverty exhibit came from the U.S. Census Bureau data. The actual detail by county and how it's measured was made available to staff. They have a copy of that to provide you.
That's not my question. You know, in order to come up with poverty, the levels of poverty, there has to be components that go into that in order to determine poverty. And mine is just wanting to know what those feeds are.
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, thank you for that clarification, and we will see what the data is in regard to those feeds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Continuing, the last element that we're going to talk about specifically in regard to the public health budget is the other funds portion of the budget, which is $91.7 million. This is sort of presented to sort of point out that the other fund revenues support almost 50% of the entire staff workforce at the state level for public health. The major contributors of this other fund revenue, as pointed out earlier, are the fees, such as the regulatory fees from radiation and drinking water, as well as the big revenue items from the tobacco use reduction account and medical marijuana. The fees portion represents 58% of the public health budget, and we're going to be talking a little bit more in regard to the next bill measure that's on the agenda for today, as well as the more detailed discussion next week when we go into phase two for the information that that Chair Nathanson had requested in the overview in regard to where do we stand with fees and when were they last adjusted, who's impacted by this, and who pays these fees. A little bit of history in regard to the public health budget as far as a historical look over the last 15 years. This helps illustrate the points that Lillian was making earlier in regard to the general fund contribution of the budget has virtually remained somewhat flat, or it usually has only fluctuated between 8% and 10% over the past 10 years. The other fund revenues, of course, have increased primarily for those specific targeted other fund revenues, such as medical marijuana and the tobacco use reduction account that contribute to that. The federal fund revenue sources have increased, but again, one of the challenges that we have there, as expressed by both the committee and Lillian in yesterday's presentation, is that most of those federal funds come to us with a very specific categorical and targeted use. So public health does their best in regard to making sure they're actually reaching a broader community-based effort. But at the same time, usually the maternal child health, the Centers for Disease Control are very prescriptive around what those grants and federal dollars can be used for. Some of the investment opportunities that are included in the governor's budget for public health that we'll be talking about a bit more as well in phase two is the investment to support the planning and operational readiness in order to prepare, respond, and mitigate public health disasters. Again, as what was illustrated earlier, we have issues such as the Ebola outbreak, meningitis, and other emerging issues that public health virtually has a very thin margin by which to respond or have to rely upon the federal dollars that are within their budget. There is support for House Bill 2348. This is the 2013 recommendations of the future of public health. And then there's an increase in the Patient Safety Commission. Again, as I pointed out earlier, these are pass-through dollars in regard to their efforts in regard to the data and monitoring that they do on behalf of patient safety information. Some of the reductions that were built into the governor's budget include removing general fund support from the contraceptive care program. Again, this is in a direct anticipation in regard to the enrollments where so many of the contraceptive care clients are likely eligible under the Affordable Care Act now, and so therefore are basically receiving their services at an enhanced match rate directly from the ACA. And then there's also a redirect of what's called the Master Settlement Agreement, the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. Again, these are the settlement dollars that the state receives and distributes to both the Oregon Health Plan and Public Health in the 13-15 budget. The 15-17 budget redirects the Master Settlement Agreement dollars into the Oregon Health Plan.
Yes, Representative Delaney Dyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you talk a little bit more about both those reductions? I've heard in the contraceptive care program that since the ACA implementation, numbers have leveled off but still not dropped. So I'm concerned about removing that entirely. So I'd love to hear about that. And then in the tobacco cessation reduction, if you could please tell us what that money went for before and what the plan is now that $4 million is not going there. Does that leave a huge gap in those services, or is that supposed to be picked up somewhere else?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, in the contraceptive care program, much like what we have seen in the breast and cervical cancer program that I saw stated earlier, we did see a decline with literally at January 2014 in the enrollment in the contraceptive care program, so the numbers did drop. We're trying to analyze the data in regard to where we feel that the numbers are starting to level off, and then what if we do have that leveling off, what do those dollars support? So we're currently analyzing that data. We make it available to staff, and then what we have to do is we have to sort of determine that is the reimbursement rate appropriate, and are we reaching the right targeted populations now if so many of our population is under the Affordable Care Act, because the program does identify and know that there's still yet another population out there that doesn't sort of fit into each of those categories.
Just to follow up on that, will we be able to have that data before we make decisions on our budget?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes.
Okay,
we'll
make
that available to you. And then, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, to your second question in regard to the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, I'm going to ask Lillian to address specifically what the dollars for the MSA were targeted for in the current biennium, because this is the only time period in which they received MSA money. Prior to that, The tobacco prevention education program is funded primarily from its ballot measure 44, or tobacco use reduction account, and a federal grant.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Grier, I think the place that we're really looking at now is what was the work that was done with that, and how can we support that with the money that we have now, you know, and where are changes that need to be made across that. Most of that money went out to local communities, so we're trying to get some feedback on that, how that works with the tobacco program going forward.
So can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
So does this remove all the money? The $4 million was all that went out to communities, and so they're losing 100%, or did it used to be $8 million and now we're reducing it to $4
million? The other money that Bill talked about, the
Tura,
that is still there, and that is most of it goes out to communities. So this money was used basically for not-for-profits, and we're looking at where the problems are and who's still smoking, where those problems are, and targeting it. We're in conversation with our community partners around that, both through the governmental but also the non-governmental, the advocate groups as well. One of the things that happens when that money moves in is it becomes eligible now for match. So that was one of, I think, the decisions that went in. So it makes it, it enhances and leverages that $4 million in a way that it didn't in the last budget, because it just came to public health.
So follow up. So two questions to that. One is that $4 million is what percent of tobacco prevention efforts through the different Tura and others? Is this half of the money that we had out there? And secondly, in terms of the match, going to the OHP match, it's not designated toward tobacco prevention at all. It helps with the match, but it's not. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I can figure out, I don't have with me the percentage of it is of the total tobacco cessation program and the tobacco prevention programs that we have.
Okay, so just,
Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Tura money is tobacco tax money, is about $16 million a biennium.
Okay.
So significantly more.
So
than
this is
four.
A 20% cut in our tobacco prevention, basically. The, 16 plus 4.
That came through
million.
Public health.
Thank you.
It's Senator Bates.
Yeah, we've made decisions, and we can talk about it more later, but I mean, a lot of decisions to match this with federal dollars and basically triple what we can get done.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it goes into CCOs who have a metric that says reduce your smoking, mm-hmm. remembering that the Medicaid population smokes roughly twice as much as the other populations do.
Mm-hmm.
We also talked to CDC last session of what's the most effective way to get people to quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't tell us. There's no good data about what really works. And they said every program works. You have to do all the programs to make it work. I said, well, what? When we talked to them directly, they said, which are the ones we should put priority on?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know.
CDC said that's really pretty great reports.
Yeah. And so when you try to track this stuff down, we know we're driving cigarette smoking down, with the exception of young people and with the exception of the Medicaid population. So we're missing a target here.
Mental health and addiction.
So I believe that's just me anecdotally. I think that's where the problem lies. I think it's mental health and addictions where we have to work. But I don't know. I don't know for sure. I don't have data for that. I can't prove that, but I'm suspicious. I'm going to be pretty strong about continuing to make this match money, because we get so much more bang for our buck out of it that way. And leaning on the CCOs to really work hard on tobacco prevention. I think that's what we have to have them do.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I wonder if, as reading this someplace, that this, and it might be related, but it's for the kids part, they have been reacting very strongly for years now to how models look, and women models in magazines, et cetera, and in the media. And so there's this new, and I think it's another country, I don't know, but they're gonna make models meet a certain weight
Sweden's
criteria.
Doing that, yeah.
And so I'm thinking, you know, if we can use people, maybe, you know, how they do public service ads, it was really helpful for breast cancer and AIDS and HIV, using public figures like famous models and actors or whatever. But maybe that's a way to go and have them. Remember the guy, the Gurney guy, who had the cigarette and say, "This is, you know, smoking. This is what smoking will do to you." But maybe just that outreach from somebody or some group that they're listening to more than their parents and their doctors.
Okay, let's keep going.
Madam Chair, other considerations that will come up as far as the public health budget for 15-17, that's part of the governor's budget, is part of the agenda for the fee bill, which basically will help us maintain public service and safety, specifically within radiation protection for regulation of tanning, x-ray machines, and healthcare facilities. And then another element called ORLAP, which is the Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. This is specifically targeted around the implementation of Measure 91 and the public health lab's responsibility in order to do marijuana testing as far as quality assurance.
Never thought I'd hear that other word, those words uttered here.
It's a growing business, no pun intended.
I've got a question on, can you go back one slide, please?
Yeah, I'll go back.
Thank you. I remember when a bill came through the legislature a few years ago on needing to make sure that we were doing what we needed to test tanning beds and x-ray equipment and so forth. What do we know about this? There is a fee on this type of equipment and on licensing, and it's to protect the public health. What are they finding? Are they finding any faulty equipment? Are we making sure that that people aren't exposed to something they're not exposed to? What are we finding?
All of the above, I would say. And, you know, we just recently had a case where in a healthcare facility there was a machine that was not calibrated correctly. And the work that was done because of the standards that we set up and how people have to report the standards, not only our on-site inspections, but also reports that have to go in and regular criteria for quality control. You know, it came about that could have provided harm for patients that were using that. So it is all of those elements, Representative Nathanson, that you pointed out, you know, like the come together. It's not just it's not just the stick, it's also the carrot, you know. And I think, you know, our philosophy is that we are there as a regulatory agency in partnership because we both have the same goal. You know, the goal is to have, for the businesses to have, you know, safe outcome, be able to provide a product, whether it is a tanning booth, you know, or a high-stakes clinical diagnostic exam, that the people operating that equipment want the same thing that we do. And we're kind of in a partnership around that for protection.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we've been foreshadowing, I think, this slide for a while now, the Future of Public Health Task Force, and which resulted was the task force that was charged by all of you in the last legislative session. It met for 9 months and did a report that became known as a roadmap for modernizing public health in the state of Oregon. And the task force recommendations, the modernization report, have been interpreted into House Bill 3100. So what is it? The task force creates a public health system for the future in Oregon that is explores different structures that would be able to be chosen by local communities to meet the needs once the standards are set out that they have to do. The other thing that I think is important about it, besides the fact that it engages the communities around what is it that we come up with a common definition definition of what we should have in every community to protect the public's health. Why now? The advent of healthcare transformation, both on the federal and particularly here in Oregon, really gives us an opportunity to relook at a lot of the work that we're doing, both individually and programmatically, to a more system approach. There's a large disparity, as you know, in level of funding for different jurisdictions, as well as what the state can provide. How we focus on really what is it that is foundational. And, you know, I always say, you know, this was the product of our process here in Oregon, but we kind of didn't do it in a vacuum. These issues of what is a foundational capability for governmental public health, kind of in a covenant with the citizens that they represent and that are looking to them to protect them. What are these foundational capabilities that it shouldn't matter where you live in a state or a region, you should be able to count on getting these services. And these, this is kind of comes from a number of years of study, both with the Institute of Medicine work that's happened in other states. The foundational programs are a list of programs that actually would be the kinds of things that we would expect to be able to deliver, whether it's the state or the locals delivering, to have those foundational capabilities realized. And also to have an accreditation as a goal as well going forward. That lines up with the public health accreditation work that's been happening in communities as well as at the state level. As you can imagine, this is the goal of this is for us to really have a plan and come back to all of you at the next legislative session. So the heavy lifting will happen in between if this bill passes and when we come back in 18 months for your consideration about is this the system that we want to have or are these the changes that we want to have made here.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
just a quick comment. I really want to thank the House and Mitch, Representative Mitch Greenlee, for taking the initiative on this. They've done a great job. It's hard for the Senate to say that to the House, but we do sometimes. Guys have done a great job on this. It's been a lot of hard work, and especially Representative Greenlee's work on this. I'm looking forward to being able to vote on the bill in a positive fashion. And I just want to call out the thank you very much for the work. It's a lot of hard work to make this kind of a change, but it's perfect timing with the ACA and changes going on in healthcare. You're getting back to, I like the word foundational, things you really should be doing, getting back to doing them, not picking up the pieces from a healthcare system that's non-functional. So thank you very much. You guys did a great job.
Just quickly, because we are running out of time, I'm aware of what we tried to do here is look at how our funding works and where it works and the factors that affect health. And you have this in your guidance and how much money gets invested in different places in the health pyramid, both for long-lasting interventions as well as changing the context of the interventions that we have. And we use this as an example by looking at some of the tobacco work that we use and the colorectal cancer screening, asthma and arthritis. But it's how we're trying to, getting back to how we are going to implement the modernization work, we have to think about our work this way as a continuum of where are we needing to make our investments so that we can get the long range results. Major budget issues, I'm going to turn it back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, the major budget issues I think we've already touched on when we talk about the specific revenue sources that come within each of the various centers. And this is simply meant to point out, again, the dependency on federal funds. We have targeted grants that require categorical efforts. Again, the dependency in the current state, of course, on the medical marijuana revenues to support key public health functions such as emergency medical services and drinking water. And of course, then what we'll also be interested in doing is having a more in-depth discussion in phase two that sort of targets a redesign of some of our fee-based programs that will be necessary in order to keep up with current demand in the areas such as vital records, the laboratory testing, and other drinking water fees as well.
There are several public health legislative concepts that have come before you. One is for establishing the traumatic brain industry registry, which we have, but it'll enable us to do epidemiological studies on that, and also our radiation protection fees, which will come before you later in this session. Things to keep in mind during the budget review, basically this public health task force will be the work that we do. We'll be looking at how we integrate all of our work together. Alignment with transformation, changes in the funding at the federal level all need to be represented as we go forward. And also with our partners, both input as well as really understanding who should be doing what and at what level in the system. And also our commitment to you for transparency in all of the work that we do going forward and with our constituents as well. I'm going to conclude now by asking Holly Mercer to come up and report on her budget for Ways and Means. And as you know, we're in a transition, so we're doing it together, Holly and I, around the Health Licensing Office. So you want to stay?
Madam Chair, as we're leaving, I'd like to see a comprehensive review of all your fees presented to us next couple of weeks.
Yeah,
time to do a cleanup now, let's do it now because we're in a tight budget.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we'll make sure the fees are adequate for the programs you're running.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, comprehensive.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm director of the Health Licensing Office. I will make this very brief. We tried to capture in this one slide 80% of our facts around our office. We have 35 FTE. We have over 70,000 licenses that we monitor. That translates to about 40,000 people. We conduct 7,000 examinations a year at our offices for a variety of 12 boards and commissions. This is not actually representative of our management structure. We only have three managers for our 35 FTE. I have administrative services, which is the policy group. We've collapsed fiscal and licensing into one manager and then regulation. The challenge and the message that I would like to get in a very brief message, I only smile because Senator Bates helped facilitate a meeting until 7 p.m. last night on our very smallest board, the Behavior Analyst Regulatory Board. We put our 12 boards in order of license volume, and the last three, if you take the Sex Offender Treatment Board on the left-hand column, Board of Directors and Midwives, and the Behavior Analyst Board on the right-hand column, all have less than 100 licensees. All of those boards are operating in the red. The midwife board is trending upwards. We're very optimistic about that board, getting along very well. Sex offender treatment board is our most in the red at about $100,000 in the red. And then the behavior analyst regulatory board came out of Senate Bill 365 in the 2013 session. We are working on a bill with Senator Bates, Senate Bill 696, to make some corrections with the administrative portion and actually to have that board perhaps go through Senate confirmation, which we did not have in the last session. Our budget is on the next page. Most of it is personal services, as you can see. It did not increase from the last biennium. We have not increased FTE from the last biennium. You're going to see some legislation coming before you, potentially Senate Bill 696. We have an advanced esthetician bill, House Bill 2642, that really will create our second largest board if it passes of about 2,600 200 to 3,000 advanced estheticians. These are laser services, and we look forward to working with Public Health and the Radiation Protection Services section. They will be an ex officio member of that board if that legislation goes through. The challenge and the viability of this structure to have an umbrella type of structure for boards is to make sure that we have a high volume, low risk board, and that's the cosmetology board as the anchor board. The more that we add low volume, high risk boards, it may tip that balance. And we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep fees as low as possible, because all of these boards probably get less attention than they do as some of the independent boards. And I think that they kind of put up with that because we keep their fees viable and within range. So it's a dynamic, very small group of people that I think are incredibly dedicated to servicing these businesses and these licensees and keeping the public safe. So that is all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I have a question about when you use the phrase high volume, low risk, mm-hmm. or high risk. How are you defining risk?
So risk is, I think, Chair Nathanson, I think it's defined both in terms of the public safety standpoint, are injuries occurring, do we have bad outcomes, and also from a financial standpoint. I think that if we don't keep these boards trending in the right direction financially, you're relying on the other boards in the umbrella to offset that. And I think we're very transparent with the cosmetology board. We convey to them the numbers that we have boards operating in the red, but I think that they are fine as long as we keep their fees reasonable. And the risk comes with legal fees. It comes from, of course, loss, legal analysis, and just that ongoing, and that's a direct cost to our boards. And I'm a believer of prevention in the legal area, and I think it's better to get advice early and try to take care of some of these things on the front end. So that's how we define it.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What percentage is your FTE? So you have 35 FTE, which if you divide that into 7.4 million is like 211,000. Mm-hmm. So you're spending obviously money on legal and other things. What's the percentage of FTE, and of the ones that are non-FTE, what are the biggest cost drivers? Is it legal? You know,
yes.
Outside consulting.
Yes. Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer. In the past, actually, our agency had some significant risk charges. Mm-hmm. Those would come through kind of the tort liability civil and through DASC risk. But we also had some personnel actions back in 2008, 2009 mm-hmm. that had significant lawsuits and risk associated with that. So we had a very, very heavy hit in the last biennium on risk charges. But we are in a flat rate with the DOJ. We really like that model, except for the midwives. We peeled that off because it has been somewhat unstable in terms of the legal costs. But we pay a flat rate per month to DOJ, and then that's adjusted at the end of biennium, and it works very well because it gives us the prediction that we need for our budget.
Mm-hmm. So that's a big piece of that non-FTE expense?
That is correct.
Anything else? Thank you. It looks like we completed everything we needed to get through for this public hearing, actually for the public hearing on both bills. Thank you for being
with
us.
And just you go ahead and leave, but thank you for the work last night. And, you know, you did drive me to drink. I mean, I had to go home and have two glasses of wine. I'm yeah. sorry. I just, it was brutal last night.
Yes. We're adjourned. I don't want the rest on the record.